It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How does a handmade artisan bow tie make a fashion statement and an environmental statement as well? It does if you are today's guest on The Confluence. Nisha Blackwell is the founder, the creative force behind Knotsland, a homegrown Pittsburgh company that is making fashionable neckwear and some national headlines as well. Nisha Blackwell, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
All right. 5 years ago, if I said to you, you're going to be an entrepreneur, you're going to start and operate a successful fashion business, you're going to do it in your home neighborhood, Homewood, and you're going to draw national attention, what would your reaction have been then?
I would have laughed. I would have laughed. I mean, I never, ever could have imagined having a bow tie company at that. I grew up around entrepreneurs, but I never thought that I would be an entrepreneur. So, yeah.
Mm-mm. Okay. So I understand that you were in nursing school at the time, working at a coffee shop to help pay the bills. You got laid off, and a friend's daughter's birthday party was coming up. Really limited funds, if any, to really provide that nice gift. So what happened?
I kind of looked around at my resources. I was in a panic because I wanted to do something really, really special, and I didn't have the financial resources to do so. And I'm like, what do I have that I can like really take to the next level? And I had a sewing machine that was still in a box in the corner, and I had a bag of thrifted fabric, and I made it work.
All right. Now, hold on a second. You had a new sewing machine, but had you been sewing all along?
No, never sewed.
Hold on. You had a sewing machine in a box and you hadn't used it. You didn't know how to use it.
Did not know how to use it. I was actually intimidated. I was afraid I was going to break it. So it sat in the corner in the box for about 5 months before I even would touch it.
Okay. So, well, you obviously made something from it. Self-taught?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank goodness for online or what?
Oh, my goodness. Thank goodness for YouTube. And Google, the Google machine. Basically, I pulled up YouTube and I was like, how do I use this? I typed in the model of the sewing machine and a bunch of videos came up and I'm like, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. And I rewind as many times as I needed to. And I mean, literally zoomed in on certain aspects, like everything from like figuring out how to turn the thing on to what plugs go where, every single thing I've learned from typing it in YouTube.
Right. So I guess you had it up here what you wanted to make for this daughter of your friend. I mean, well, something came up. You made hair bows.
Yeah.
But it was like, now, how do I get from this point to that point?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, it literally felt like forever, but it was all night that I was up teaching myself how to sew, first of all. And then I finally was able to make some stitches. I'm like, okay, I need to just go for what I have. I had some ribbon. I had some hair ties. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to make all of these things work.
And obviously, they were a hit at the party.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was super duper shy when I first went. I mean, she's been my friend since preschool, so she kind of knows that I've always been a little creative. So I gave her the box and I was like, hey, you know, I was afraid they were going to fall apart, like when the baby opened the box. And so I was like, hey, you know, I'm creative and I just wanted to like show how much I love Runasia and just like really make something special. And she's like, oh, I'm not worried about it. Thank you. I'm just happy you're here. I'm happy you came. So then during the time when the baby went to, you know, when everyone crowds around the baby in the high chair and she's opening the gifts, and literally like everyone was like, oh my gosh, where did she get those from? And I was kind of in the background because I, again, was nervous that they would be like scraps on the chair. And it was the reverse. I left that party with at least five customers.
So all right, so now you have customers, but when did it hit you that, all right, I can make this for friends or friends of friends, but it's not a business? When did it hit you say, I can make a living out of this, or I can, let me try to start making a living out of this?
Well, it wasn't until actually, it was later after I made the bow ties. Like, so, you know, later in the summer, they started requesting things for little boys. And so a friend of mine was like, it'd be cool if you made bow ties. So I went into like this heavily like space where I was like researching and developing like what it would look like to make a bow tie. I've never had an attachment to a bow tie. So I was like, okay, I have to figure this out.
And any men in your family wear bow ties?
No. Okay. No one. So with that, a friend of mine was like, you know, now that you're making these bow ties, you should go apply to one of the startups. startup accelerators in the city. And I was like, oh, come on. Like, I'm just doing this to, you know, I'm in nursing school. I'm trying to like just make some extra money. And she was like, no, I think you're onto something. You know, you have this, you're using reused materials and, you know, you're just doing these things that I think would be cool for you to at least try to apply. Mm-hmm. So that's when I applied. And once I got into the accelerator, I was like, okay, I could take this seriously. I have to take it seriously because now I can't just like go in here, you know, right. I'm like not knowing what I'm walking into, but also like whatever happens, happens.
It's no longer a hobby to make a few bucks.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, okay, now I have to take this seriously. And when I got in a room of 100 entrepreneurs and looked around, I'm like, oh, yeah, I have to like step it up.
Well, you did. Your first employee was your younger brother?
Yes, yes. My little brother, I mean, he supported me so much throughout the beginning of Nosland and just like every single thing I needed him to do, he was there for me, including modeling the bow ties.
I've seen images of him. He makes a sharp model, let me tell you, for your product.
He does. He's great. And he has the personality for it. I had him actually come to my second pitch where I had to do our final pitch for the accelerator.
Right.
And he was beside me with a bow tie on, and apparently I guess he was like doing hand gestures and like, you know, being him. He's part of why I think I like got through the accelerator, because my pitch I was like I could have done better, but then there's my little brother with all this personality like and a bow tie on. I'm like, thank you for sealing the deal.
Well, the deal had been sealed, and I mean, you know, you did this, you were encouraged to go through the accelerator project, the accelerator program. But had you had any business experience prior to that, business education, anything?
Zero business education. Again, I did grow up around entrepreneurial women. Like, you know, I had aunts who would, you know, create businesses and sell different things and sell Avon. So I've always seen like what it was like to work for yourself. And I just never felt it, you know, for myself until this happened. Yeah. Wow.
All right. At the beginning of our conversation, I alluded to the environmental component of your enterprise. How did that become sort of part of your mission?
So it goes back to my roots. We always thrifted growing up, and I didn't really see it as like a trendy, cool thing. Mm-hmm. And basically, when I grew up, I still kept this like idea of like, I love to like get these rare items and pieces of clothing that no one else had. So I had gotten into this like this cool like online Instagram community where I would like buy things from California, I would buy things from Chicago, I would buy, and not always because they were vintage sizes would they fit really well. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do something with these. So I would put them in a bag. Like I do generally give things to the VA, but right. There are always certain things that I just love the print. I love the pattern. And I'm going to keep these. So that was the first source of fabric that I used for the hair bows. And so I knew that I'm like, you know, this is something like there's so much fabric here that could be used instead of me like tossing it out or getting rid of it. I just would look around the house at like different things, like especially project based things like, oh, yeah, I wanted to redo my pillows and I never used that fabric. Oh, I can actually use it for these bow ties and for the hair bows, you know. So it started as just like I'm using the resources that I have. And I'm like, wow, this is, you know, actually doing something good. And I didn't even realize it, you know.
Right. So how do you go about sort of preventing the rescuing of materials that would be headed for a landfill and turning those into the beautiful bow ties? Who do you work with?
Our primary source is Pittsburgh Center for Creative Reuse. Mm-hmm. I love that place so much. I mean, when I first started my business, I remember like I was like an ant. I would beeline because it's super close to my home, and I would beeline there and just go and check out the fabric section. It was just like this like hidden treasure. So Creative Reuse is still one of those main sources, but we've also collaborated with the Pittsburgh Opera, who has given us some of their things from their costumes, and you know, they just had nothing else to do with them, which was great because we were like, yes, we'll take it.
I bet you they're happy that their lavish, beautiful costumes find a new home.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Tease Upholstery. She actually was one of the, when I was in the startup accelerator, they were like, you need to find partnerships and you need to like find where you're going to always get fabric. And so I Googled like fabric stores Pittsburgh, and Tease Upholstery was one of the first ones that came up. And she's like, got this little shop in Lawrenceville. And I called her up at first phone number. I called her up. I was like, hi, I'm looking for fabric. I just was wondering if you ever have it. She was like, come down here right now. I have a bag that I'm looking at and I want to get rid of it. Come down here right now. So like, that's when my little brother came, picked me up, and we went down, and like, huge bag of beautiful fabric. I mean, this is like high end reupholstering fabric. And it was just like, wow, we hit the jackpot.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Nisha Blackwell. She's the founder, the creative force behind Knotsland, a Homewood based, homegrown company, makes fashionable neckwear and saves materials that would be headed for the landfill otherwise. So why is it important to sort of prevent that materials? Because we don't realize some of the components that go into the materials and what they can do to our environment.
Oh, yeah. Depending on who you ask, fashion, the fashion industry as a whole is either the first or second most polluting industry in the world. And it would only come second to oil. And that's because of all of the different components in which fashion operates. You have the water that it takes to make a T-shirt or a pair of jeans, all the way to the water that's being ruined from the runoffs. And I mean, transportation, you have even the care for garments once you get them in your possession, from the energy used to wash them and clean them. And, you know, it's just like there's so many different. And when you think about the ethical, you know, component, it's just there's a lot of things that are happening with the fashion industry that's, yeah.
And some of the materials actually themselves, the polyesters, the synthetics as well.
Totally. And so once you do all of those processes and you no longer want it, a lot of individuals will just like get rid of it, toss it out as if it's like going to just like go away. But it's like really educating people on how to take responsibility before it goes away, because it doesn't really go away. It goes into landfills and it takes forever to biodegrade, because a lot of times it's like cotton blends, like blended with polyester and nylon, things that don't, like they take forever to biodegrade, even if they do.
Right. We have just about 4 minutes left. I want to get a couple things. I want to talk about Homewood. Born, raised. You have this company. Why did you want to make sure it stayed in Homewood to help revitalize your old neighborhood? What?
Absolutely. I grew up during a time where I watched like Homewood kind of decline a bit, and it was just seemed as though it was just like a neglected neighborhood. And I knew that there was a reason I boomeranged back to my grandfather's house in that same community, walked the streets, and I was like, I just want to be a part of positive change. And when I came, I just like figured out how to get involved with. I got involved with the Re-Energize Pittsburgh program through GTEC, now Grounded, and that was when I started saying, okay, I need to like really build something more than, you know, just kind of going to meetings. I wanted to like build something that was like helpful to the revitalization in the long run.
All right. Your employees, about how many are most of them women? Do they have experience as seamstresses? What?
Yeah. So our seamstress community is the power behind Knotsland.
The word community.
Yeah. Yeah. And we build a community of women who we recruit and train to sew the bow ties. They take their materials home and they sew from home. But like I say that in such a space in which it's so much more than that. Like women are really invested in the growth. Like we have people who come from a little outside, like more like past Monroeville, who right. will come pick up pieces, and they're always all over the place, like trying to figure out ways to grow Knotsland, and they're just passionate beyond that. So it's so great to build this community of women who are just carrying us. It's just, it's amazing.
As we've learned throughout our little talk here, I mean, self-taught in terms of making the bow tie, self-taught in terms of developing a business. Are you helping them along, encouraging them to sort of get into the business world, not just I'm making a product for my boss?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I encourage that. I mean, that's why we have flexible income opportunities, because when I started Knotsland, I worked at different places to make sure that I had money to infuse into my business. And so I wanted to create an opportunity for other people who may want to start a business or grow a business to be able to make extra money and not have to be like, you know, like strapped to a place or a time for a certain period of time. You know, it's kind of like the Ubering idea, the skill sharing. If you, right. Yeah.
Right. You want to sort of help them avoid a couple of the steps maybe that you had to take.
Totally. Totally.
All right. In our remaining minute or so, I want to ask you, I mentioned at the beginning, national attention. Now, you've created a line of bow ties for the highly respected men's store, Larimore's, and I believe also Macy's in Atlanta, Philadelphia Fashion Week. So I go back to my first question about a few years back. So this Homewood-based business, fledgling business that started with hair bows, getting national attention, what's your reaction?
I feel like it's walking in my purpose. It's a combination. I mean, when people receive a bow tie in a little package, they receive that bow tie, but there's so many more things intertwined, from the environmental aspect all the way to the social component. So it's really allowed me to combine all of the things that I really love and that I'm passionate about and put them into this product, you know. So I think people feel that, people see that, and people support that. And it's a company that people get behind because of all of the values.
Nisha Blackwell is the founder and owner of Homewood-based Knotsland. Nisha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Just ahead on The Confluence, the Trump administration hasn't prioritized environmental protection at the national level, but some cities like Pittsburgh are. Coming up, WESA's Kathleen Davis explores our local goals and where they fit into the global effort to combat climate change. Allegheny County's winter shelters are open to those with housing insecurity, and for the first time, they'll be available every night, not just when the temperatures dip below 25 degrees. And the Fred Rogers Company is using its platform to continue counseling children and families in the wake of the Tree of Life shooting. Those stories, conversations, and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Century 3 Mall in West Mifflin avoided another sheriff's sale this week. On Monday, the struggling mall was supposed to go to sale, but instead will remain in limbo as it waits for another order of sale from the court. It was last purchased in 2013 for $10.5 million. And a new study finds marijuana is not a gateway drug to bad behavior and hard drugs. In fact, it's the other way around. Researchers say behaviors such as lying, stealing, or skipping school are predictive of marijuana use. Find more top news at our website at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. World leaders are gathered in Poland this week to talk about how to fight climate change. The U.S. is not there. While the Trump administration is not prioritizing environmental protection when it comes to climate change, some cities, including Pittsburgh, are trying to pick up the slack. Here's Mayor Bill Peduto.
We have the ability to address these issues on a local level. We can discuss them on the national level and the international level, but when it gets right down to it, it's implemented on a local level.
Peduto was speaking at an October press conference announcing a $2.5 million grant from Bloomberg Philanthropies to help Pittsburgh reach its ambitious climate and energy goals. But 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis reports achieving them won't be easy.
The city-county building in downtown Pittsburgh is a massive stone structure that's more than 100 years old. Grant Irvin, Pittsburgh's chief resilience officer, says the city has started to track power usage levels in the building.
So you can see, oh, these people over here in this west wing are really consuming a lot of power. Why is that? Well, there's servers over there.
Irvin says they've even found some offices had their heaters and air conditioning units running at the same time. Knowing where energy is wasted allows the city to increase efficiency, getting it closer to one of its energy goals, cutting carbon emissions citywide by half by 2030. Old buildings like the city county building are generally not very energy efficient, and Pittsburgh has a lot of them. Buildings are responsible for about 80% of the city's overall greenhouse gas emissions. Julie Hughes is a building energy expert based in Washington, D.C.
Existing buildings are tricky to tackle because engaging building owners and investors in retrofits, it does take the education. It does take effort to raise awareness.
Aside from reducing emissions, Pittsburgh also wants to implement 100% renewable energy for municipal buildings and reduce water consumption citywide by half, all by 2030. Inez Azevedo is the co-director of Carnegie Mellon University's Center for Climate and Energy Decision Making. She says those are ambitious goals.
And they may tend to be unrealistic unless you have an enormous amount of resources and policies that are tailored to achieving those goals in the expected time frame.
Our goals are audacious by intent.
Here's Grant Irvin with the city again.
The challenge of climate change is one that should not be taken lightly. It's kind of a clear and present danger that we're dealing with as local government, as well as residents.
Pittsburgh's ambitious climate and energy goals are a product of the Peduto administration, which might not be around in 2030. Irvin says that's okay, because achieving these goals goes beyond city government.
The city can't act by itself. And we've had in years past, in the prior two climate action plans, you know, a lot of investment by the university sector, by the private sector, by nonprofit organizations to be partners in that. And I think that collaborative spirit will endure beyond the mayor's administration.
But the city's goal of moving to 100% renewable energy in the next decade is dependent on entities far outside city limits. Azevedo with CMU says the electrons that power city buildings and infrastructure can come from anywhere in a wide swath of the eastern U.S.
This really makes it important to look at the emissions of the region rather than something more local.
At the end of November, the Trump administration released a report on climate change, warning that a warming planet could devastate the country's economy and create a public health crisis. Trump himself disputed the findings. Amanda Eakin is with the National Resources Defense Council.
As we've seen, the federal government has abdicated its responsibility to act on climate. So we need to be looking to all levels of government to lead on climate action.
Pittsburgh isn't alone in setting ambitious goals. Dozens of other cities around the globe are seeking to drastically cut emissions and energy usage. Though strategies differ, there's a shared sense of urgency. From landslides in Pittsburgh to flooding in Houston to wildfires in California, cities have no choice but to confront the challenges brought about by a warming planet. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. After an unseasonably warm Sunday, the temperatures have been getting more seasonal all this week. That means cold. Many people are looking for a warm place to spend the night. Brian Matush is the homeless services supervisor with Pittsburgh Mercy. Welcome to The Confluence, Brian.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
So the winter shelter officially opened November 15th and will be open each night through March 15th, correct?
That's correct.
Now, this is different from the way it used to be for years and years.
For years and years, the county's answer to homelessness has always been that if the temperatures drop below 25 degrees, then we would open up a homeless shelter so that people don't freeze to death outside. Mm-hmm. And we've now moved over to what we call a winter seasonal model, which means that we're open every single day from November the 15th to March the 15th.
So what challenges has that posed, that, you know, four-month period, but also what opportunities has it also helped?
We see most of the opportunities. I'm not even sure. I guess challenges, just because it's a long 4 months. It's all evening hours. We're open from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. But really, more the benefits have really outweighed the challenges. You know, I can now actually hire a team of people and be able to look at resumes and pull people with skill sets in that are going to be wonderful to work with our homeless friends in the community. So the staffing has been it's been amazing to actually hire a team of people to work over those 4 months. Before, it was like, can you work, can you not? You know, that back and forth. So,
and you had to wait for the forecast, basically.
That's right. We had to. We called it every 3 days, but there was always those times that something would fall apart and the bottom would drop out of the weather. Another really big, huge benefit for us is that before, we didn't know if we were going to be open. So if someone came up on a list of ours that we needed to start working with for a certain program, we didn't know for sure if we were going to see them because we didn't even know if we were going to be open. Mm-hmm. So if the way it worked is, you know, they would call us and let us know we need to find, you know, Joe Smith. And if we didn't see Joe Smith for 2 weeks because the weather was warm, then a lot of times people could fall through the cracks that way. So it's really great to have a place for people to be able to lay their head, you know, for a period of nights so that we can address all the challenges and struggles that they have.
Right. I want to talk about those additional ones. In addition to just getting a warm place to sleep, cooperative effort. Who else is involved in addition to Pittsburgh Mercy?
Sure. It's my personal goal for our shelter system is that we look at it as a community project. So for the last 3 years that I've been involved with this project, I've really tried to help other providers around the city understand that the space is theirs as well. So we invite in different people from different agencies. So one of our biggest competitors will say, you know, is UPMC, Western Psych. You know, they may be a big competitor of ours. For us, we look at it as inviting them in to work with. We can't serve everyone. So mm-hmm. we invite different partners in, different agencies will come in to work with people in the evenings. There's quite a bit of corporate support throughout Pittsburgh. It's an extremely generous city. So all of those people are invited in once we open the shelter after 7. And then there's about a 2.5 hour window of time that we have to work before people are just exhausted and ready to go to bed. So mm-hmm. that's a big focal point for us, those first 2.5 hours the shelters are open.
On average, on a nightly basis, how many people are you serving?
We serve about 120 average. When we look back at history, like you said, we've had some nice warm weather. We just now moved back into Smithfield United Church of Christ. We've been there for 20-plus years. Don't quote me on exact years, but right. I know it's been a long time. So we ended up, our friends over at Shepherd's Heart in Uptown opened their doors to us, as they always do when we need help. So we've been sheltering there for the last 2 weeks. Last night was our first night to be back in Smithfield United. The plus to that is it's a lot larger. So we can serve, on average, about 130 total people per day.
Well, let's talk about other services in addition to that immediate need of a warm place to sleep. Is part of the challenge identifying who needs what services in addition to that bed?
Yeah, we, you know, people laugh at me because I feel a lot of times there's that old saying where people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of our time getting to know the people that we serve and building relationships with them, because until they trust us, it could be very difficult for us to find out exactly what they need help with. So we have a whole team of people at Operation Safety Net underneath the Pittsburgh Mercy umbrella that are out in the streets. We have an outreach team. We've got a medical team that takes medical care to the streets and into our shelter system. So, you know, we spend a lot of time getting to know them. And once we do get to know them, that's when we understand they may be suffering with a pretty persistent mental illness. They may have a drug or alcohol problem. I like to explain it like this. For you and I, we may have one struggle. We may suffer with depression or anxiety. The folks that we serve have got about 5 or 6 barriers in many cases that they struggle with, each person. So it's up to us to kind of address the whole person. And that's what we do at Pittsburgh Mercy with most of our services.
How do you connect them, say, with housing services?
Sure.
If they're indeed looking for a permanent place to stay?
Absolutely. So we work with the coordinated entry system in Allegheny County. It's called the Allegheny Link. It's the very first step. Anybody that's having any sort of housing crisis or any crisis at all, the first thing we're going to do with them is sit down, get on the telephone, or go with them in person to One Smithfield and work with our Department of Human Services team. And they'll do an assessment and kind of determine what type of support might help them get back on their feet. So that's the first step.
Right.
And then from there, we stay in contact with them over, you know, sometimes it takes people a few days to navigate through a housing crisis. Sometimes it takes them a few weeks. And then we have those that have been living outside for a very long time. It may take us a year to fully get them engaged into coming indoors and you know, reacclimating to society.
Is it a matter of time and consistency to build up that trust that you were talking about so that you can identify and assess and connect?
It's absolutely. I mean, I would say that's probably the number one thing. And we're lucky because our founder is Dr. Jim Withers. And, you know, he's the father of street medicine.
Yes.
Around the world, for that matter. And we learned that from him, that people want to know how much you really care. And so we do spend a lot of time building trust with the clients. And those are the ones that we see do well, are the ones that we've actually gotten to know. Because they're our neighbors, they're our brothers, our sisters, our mothers, uncles, aunts, you know. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, every person that we work with is someone's, you know, child.
Right. What about someone's looking for a warm place to stay? Maybe they don't have heat in their home. Maybe it's because they are on the verge of homelessness. How do you help them? Do you help them to sort of avert that homelessness challenge?
We do. So that's considered at risk of being homeless. There's many reasons that someone could be at risk of being homeless, but we actually have programs called rapid rehousing that are a part of the continuum of care in Allegheny County, and those programs are designed to work directly with people to take care, get all that stuff back in place so that they don't have to end up on the streets. So there's a lot of effort that goes towards mitigating those risks so that people don't end up in the streets or in a homeless, you know, status. And they're also welcome in our shelter. That's quite frankly how we find a lot of people, is they'll show up and they'll say, I'm not homeless yet, but I don't have heat. And we you have to have heat, right, in the winter in Pittsburgh. So, we definitely work with them.
Just about a minute left. What's on your wish list? You mentioned a lot of services, but what's on that wish list of, I wish we could still do this?
You know, we were talking about that before we came over here today, my colleague Lauren and I, and it's wonderful that we're open every night in the shelter, but it's a winter thing. So we're open for 4 months. Obviously, it would be great to have a program that spanned across the entire year. And then we could get really down into the dirt with explaining what we really want. At the end of the day, it would be nice for us to have a place when someone is willing to work with us, for them to be temporarily while we get them housed. Sometimes that can be a big challenge for us, is that 3 or 4 week window until they become housed. What happens to them? You know, things can get progressively worse for an individual.
The winter shelter will remain open until when and where?
Until March the 15th. We're at 620 Smithfield Street. It's at Smithfield United Church of Christ. We are housing both the men and the women in the same building. We've got a great team that's designed, you know, we put together to actually work with all the folks that need our help.
Brian Matush is the Homeless Services Supervisor with Pittsburgh Mercy. Thanks so much, Brian.
Great. Thanks, Kevin.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tomorrow marks 6 weeks since the horrific mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Squirrel Hill left 11 people dead. As a community, we experienced the horror, the shock, the disbelief, the sorrow, fear, maybe even anger at the extreme violence in a house of worship. Immediately after the shooting, child advocates overwhelmingly said, it's important to talk to children and listen to their concerns. But as time passes, those advocates say feelings of fear could still be lingering in children. This Sunday, the Rodef Shalom congregation wants to address those concerns with families. WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider joins us now. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, Kevin.
Sarah, you talked with the speaker in advance of her presentation Sunday at Rodef Shalom. What did she say that parents, that caregivers, that teachers should be looking for in children now that it's 6 weeks since those attacks happened?
The general consensus I hear from, you know, child advocates and child psychologists is that kids really need to feel heard after a tragedy. You know, it's important that adults are listening to them and are reassuring them that they are trying to keep them safe. As you mentioned, I spoke to Roberta Schomburg, who will be at Rodef Shalom this weekend for a conversation with families. And she says kids might not just come out and tell you that they're scared. Those feelings could become more evident in their day-to-day routines. That could be playtime. And Schomburg is the interim executive director at the Fred Rogers Center, and she says researchers see children play out scenarios, you know, months, maybe years after an event. She noted the September 11th attack. Researchers saw kids building towers with toy blocks and running toy airplanes into the blocks repeatedly, even a year after the attack, as a way to try to understand what had happened. And so she said it's important if you see those kinds of things, you know, in Pittsburgh, this was gun violence.
Right.
And so if teachers or caregivers, parents are seeing kids, you know, maybe more curious about guns, that it's important to check in on that and not say immediately, we don't play with guns. That's not something we do. But to ask, you know, what is it you're curious about? Why are you drawn to this toy?
Right.
So she said that you could see an increase in that, but telling kids that they're safe is the most important thing.
You mentioned in your reporting, Sarah, that children might have difficulty in verbally expressing what they're feeling about these traumatic events. Are there specific signs that you've learned about that for about a child being afraid, whether it's staying in their bedroom or not wanting to go outside, anything like that?
It sounds like just being withdrawn is what you should look for. And really, it's individual children are different. And so noticing changes in your child is what's important.
Let's hear what Schomburg told you.
Children can't always articulate what it is they want to know. And so it is very important to pay attention to the kinds of things they're pretending about or the kinds of things they're drawing. It gives us an avenue for having a conversation, but they may not be able to formulate the question that they have, but we can sometimes tell by changes in their behavior or clinginess or things like that, that there really is something still bothering them. I also think it's important for them to understand it's okay to feel afraid and it's okay to feel angry, that we all feel those ways from time to time, but it's what we do with the anger and what we do about the fear that really makes a difference. If the fear forces us to withdraw from interacting with others, then that's a problem. If the anger makes us do aggressive things to other people, then that's a problem. So it's how we handle the feelings, not the fact that we have the feelings, that is really important.
So what did she tell you if an adult notices some of that behavior, what they should say to the child?
She said it's most important, like she said, if you're seeing signs of anger or aggression, to not immediately discipline the child and say you're wrong for doing this, because it could be that they're scared and right. They're just trying to feel safe. And so she said to, you know, make sure that your home or your school is a safe place that kids feel like they can talk to you, but also checking in, because like I said earlier, kids might not come out and tell you I'm scared because of this shooting, and they might not know that's why they're scared.
And how can adults help children move past tragedies like Tree of Life? Not that they forget it, but that it doesn't dominate their lives, their feelings.
It's important to point out goodness that you see in the world and for kids to recognize when others are treating others kindly. And so Schomburg told me a couple good examples of ways that parents and families can recover together. That could be volunteering as a family, writing letters to loved ones, you know, even just opening a door for someone and pointing out to kids that, yes, this bad thing happened and it's very scary, but there are a lot of good things happening around us as well.
And very, very briefly, will there be a message for adults to sort of take care of themselves so that they can take care of the children?
Well, this is a congregation that caters to families, and so it is important. Self-care is important in order to take care of your kids. So I'm sure that's going to be addressed during this talk.
Sarah Schneider is the education reporter here at WESA. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can hear Roberta Schomburg from the Fred Rogers Center lead a conversation on ways to talk to kids after a tragedy this Sunday morning at 9 at the Rodef Shalom Congregation in Oakland. That talk is free and open to the public. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, bringing Clairton Coke Works into compliance with clean air standards. And we'll hear stories from residents about what it's like to live with asthma in that area. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, with production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.